Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Ambition into Action special series of the EPRI Current podcast. I am Dan Monaghan, your host, and I am joined by two wonderful guests today. For those of you who may be joining us for the first time, this is a special series of the EPRI Current podcast in the lead up to the Global Forum for Nuclear Innovation, a multinational innovation summit that is convening in June in Miami to talk about all the ways that we can help accelerate the deployment of nuclear power around the world to help make a difference in all of our decarbonization goals. We're here to talk about one of the grand challenges that was identified at the last Global Forum. In this episode, we're talking about no talent, no sector, which is really all about the idea that we need to help improve and build out the workforce. If we want to deploy as much nuclear power as we're interested in, we need to effectively triple the amount of capacity that we have around the world. And to do that requires an extremely large build out in a very diverse field of technical people so that we can have engineers designing and supporting plants. We can have constructors, fabricators, craft labor able to produce the plants and actually build them everywhere all at once. And so many more different kinds of specialties within those fields. Joining me today are two people who have made some significant strides in improving the way we're developing the workforce of the future. Please join me in welcoming Sanjay Sarma, the CEO and president of the Asia School of Business and a professor of engineering at MIT, and Steve Layton, head of engineering operations at Rolls-Royce. Sanjay and Steve, thank you both so much for being here. We've got some interesting things lined up, and I'm excited for you to be able to share your experience with our listeners. Maybe the first place to start is with Steve. Steve, you've recently gotten involved in something called the Nuclear Skills Academy. Could you tell me a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, morning, Dan. Morning, Sanjay. The Nuclear Skills Academy was set up in 2022 in response to a growing requirement for more products and services for Rolls-Royce's nuclear business. There's a real renaissance for nuclear in the UK and I guess around the world. Skills are really not there. So as a company, we chose to invest in talent and grow that talent. And that's what the Nuclear Skills Academy was very much about. Really exciting for Derby in the UK, starting out with early careers, but quickly growing into mid-career training and nuclear training as well.
I find that idea so interesting. When we talk about how businesses seem to look to position themselves, often vertical integration is one of the ways they go. If you can internalize a lot of your supply chain, you can start to buy down your risk. And extending that to probably your most valuable resource, your human resource, seems like a very sensible concept, but it doesn't seem like one that's been applied as broadly as buying up the production for a specific component you need. So it's really good to hear that this is something you're thinking about. Now, Sanjay, you lead the Asia School of Business. For someone who has spent a lot of their career in technology research, a mechanical engineer who's worked in areas like electronics, what motivated you to get involved with this particular project?
Look, thank you. First of all, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Steve. I should say good evening from Kuala Lumpur. But I am an entrepreneur. I work on technologies. I work with companies. I serve on the boards of companies. And it is my, I came to the realization a few years ago that the edifice we're bringing building industries on is weak. The labor market is extremely, I think the word is fragile today. And frankly, I think universities themselves have to up their game to provide the people that companies need, whether it's engineers or technicians or business leaders, and up and down the stack. We have a bit of a crisis, and the challenges we face are quite tremendous, whether it's energy or sustainability or, frankly, on the displacement of jobs by artificial intelligence. So it became very clear to me that we need to look at education in all sectors I worked in engineering education. I was the vice president for open learning at MIT. I have done a little bit of work on business education. I had done it in the past, and this was an opportunity to take it on at a more holistic level. So I'm excited that we're going to be looking at business education at the Asia School of Business, and we have some big plans.
That's really exciting. And you touch on a concept that's intrigued me for a while. I don't know if this is necessarily exactly the motivation you've described, but I've often heard that as we continue to develop technology with technologies that our predecessors has developed, we start to incur this knowledge debt. Because as the ability to develop and maintain increasingly complex systems grows, we don't necessarily keep the foundational understanding of the underlying technologies or processes or practices present in that workforce. And this is something that I've seen growing in how we're building out technologies, for instance, in power plants. As we shift towards these much more streamlined and optimized workforces, we begin to displace people with technology. And so the capability of those people to maintain the technology with reduced numbers and increased complexity seems like we're hurtling towards a cliff edge effect of the inability to maintain the system we've created. So it's interesting to hear you say that across all sorts of challenges, that probably isn't a unique effect.
Yeah, no, 100%. Look, I mean, people who work in, for example, as you said, electrical machinery, power plants, grids, they're retiring in large numbers. And it is not the most glamorous job for young people necessarily. So we will have a supply chain problem of resource, as you said earlier, of human capital. And all these things need systemic thinking at a global level, not just at a national level. And it's great to see what Steve is doing. And I'm hoping that we'll do some of that here at ASB.
Steve, one of the very well identified and documented challenges in the nuclear industry is this knowledge transfer from the incredibly experienced people who have essentially built and operated the majority of the current nuclear reactors we have. There have been these gaps in the workforce where there just weren't very many people there. So there hasn't been this continuous handoff of knowledge from those who created the technology we have to those who are inheriting it. Is there a discrete mechanism for giving this knowledge transfer from your own experts in the UK or around the world to the students you have in the Nuclear Skills Academy?
Yeah, there definitely is. And knowledge management, as Sanjay has said, is you know, there's a systemic solution to it all working. It's not only an internal Rolls-Royce thing. You know, obviously, if we've got people retiring, people move into different positions, we need to manage the knowledge, capture the knowledge and share it, for future generations. But we also need to do that with academia as well. We work with all the major universities and really ensuring that we grow our business, grow our technology with academia as well as internally. And the Skills Academy plays a huge part in that because it enables a different environment, if you like, for people to go learn new skills, receive new knowledge, test it in a safe environment, and then obviously reintroduce it back into the mainstream business.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of those unique ways you have of giving students a place to learn and then maybe exercise and apply some of those skills that differs from a traditional lecture-based classroom setting?
Yeah, so our specialists, we've got a lot of nuclear specialists, as you'd expect, with a big company like Rolls-Royce. We use those specialists to speak with our early career, our mid-career new starts to the business. We use simulation. We use AR and different types of technology to help learning. You know, everybody learns in a different way, and really we need to offer a variety of options, but you know, it does come back to that knowledge and ensuring you can manage that knowledge well and transfer it. So we have, you know, a number of our retirees. You know, Sanjay spoke about people retiring, and Rolls-Royce experiences that particular issue as well. And what we do is we keep a connection with those people, both before they retire and obviously after they retire, and invite them back into the Skills Academy to do guest lectures, guest talks, demonstrations with our students, and it goes down really well. We also do that with the customer as well. So regularly, we invite our customer into the Skills Academy to share their experience of our products and services and how they see technology and the environment changing. And that all helps. It all helps.
Yeah, I've often found that I learn the most about a new or growing subject when I see it from a completely different perspective, going from the developer or the producer to the end user. Definitely comes with a mindset shift. You start thinking about different things. So it's really great to see that you're including all sorts of perspectives into the way you help these people skill up. Sanjay, I'd imagine that if part of your motivation for working at the Asia School of Business is to help grow a different workforce than we've seen before, one who is better equipped to tackle the complex challenges of either modern life or what we anticipate the future being, that you're not just relying on traditional teaching styles or methods. Could you talk a little bit about some of what sets the work you're doing at the Asia School of Business apart from a pedagogic perspective?
Yeah, the MIT pedagogy is mens et manus, mind and hand. So you don't just study a book, you do something with it, you make something, you do an experiment, and you go out in the field. And so that runs through the Asia School of Business's pedagogy. We do something called action learning. And so students, when they learn, for example, how to do accounting, the idea is that, or marketing, you do a stint at a company as a team, and you take on a problem, or logistics for that matter. And this has been both successful for us in terms of, and for the students, but also frankly energizing and inspiring, because we enjoy it and the students enjoy it, and you know, everyone feels better about it. It's better pedagogy. This whole, our whole pedagogy generally is based on bookishness. You learn from a book, you're examined, everyone declares victory and goes home thinking that the problem is solved. And in fact, most work is applied. And the bookish knowledge is a framework and its application where you learn the little nuances that make the world go round. So this is very central. The other thing, though, is that even coming to campus is now proving to be an opportunity cost with technology, whether it's augmented reality, virtual reality, or just plain video. You can reach people at work. They don't have to come to campus. But we do fundamentally believe that you have to apply your work in a team setting. So we do something called hybrid education, where even if you're at work, you join virtually. And then, for example, let's say you do accounting. Would it be great if you built a simple accounting system for, you know, a dry cleaner or some case study? But the good news is, since you're doing this remotely from work, you get to apply your stuff at work. You get to, you know, look at your accounts at your company, maybe look at your P&L, maybe do accounting for a project. So the idea here is to have the best of all worlds, the theory, the social learning, the team learning with case studies or with simulations or with games, and the application in real life, all in one pedagogical journey. And that's where we're heading in our pedagogy.
I love that. I know taking heat transfer when I was back in undergrad was a pretty complex subject, and it started to make a lot more sense when we went into our unit operations learning lab and I got to just sit and play with heat exchangers and actually see and essentially get a visceral understanding, an intuitive understanding of what the equations that I had been taught actually translated to, what the response time of a system was, and what it felt like to be able to ramp between different temperatures and how they worked. So it's great that that's actually built in as a fundamental part of your approach.
This is the first time I've talked about heat transfer in a podcast, but you've risen substantially in my eyes from an already high level.
Well, I appreciate that. I probably the most fun I had in my undergrad career was in this very extensive summer learning lab we had, where we got to work with pilot scale distillation columns, heat exchangers, filters, and all these sorts of things. And it really tied together a lot of the stuff that had only made some sense as I was getting a bunch of equations sort of poured at me with a fire hose. So yeah, being able to apply your knowledge is really a great way to actually digest and understand and internalize it.
Well, I mean, just not to hog the conversation here. When you apply something, it gives you a cabinet to file things away. Otherwise, it's a mishmash and you have no idea what to do with it. It's just sort of all seems the same. But when you learn about heat transfer and you learn about convection and you actually work with a heat exchanger or a heat sink, then you know what to do with that knowledge. You feel the heat sink getting hot. You feel that it isn't cooling enough and you have to pick a different heat sink with different conductivity. These are things that make the learning durable. Otherwise, it's just, it doesn't stick.
That makes sense. And I suppose that's why a lot of, Steve, what you're doing by providing multiple different discrete opportunities for the students helps them to begin to compartmentalize the different skills they're learning. Because while, of course, they all work together in a power plant setting, it's important to know which cabinet to reach into when you're confronted with a particular problem to at least start to decompose it and to bring some tools to bear on it.
Absolutely. A big part of our Nucleus Skills Academy is apprenticeships, which is really the basis, the foundation for what you're describing. So, in the Skills Academy itself, they'll be learning the academic side, their education, learning up to sort of degree level. But very much part of their apprenticeship is getting back to site, doing attachments across the course of a four-year period, and learning about the life cycle, about the full value stream, getting some hands-on experience with either it might be a safety case or it might be physical hardware or verification and testing. And it's really important, actually, they then go back and reflect as part of academia to make sense of everything. And that's how they'll transition to something that we call SQEP, to be a suitably qualified and experienced person to carry out activity on our mainstream sort of contracts and programs.
So, to jump to a completely different perspective now, we've been talking a lot about the methods and the reasons you're doing what you're doing. Steve, you mentioned that right now Nuclear Skills Academy is focusing on these early career skills and you're looking to get towards some of the mid-career skills. Is there a vision you all are working to grow this Nuclear Skills Academy towards, recognizing that they can evolve with time?
There is a very clear vision. It obviously takes a bit of time. We set the Nuclear Skills Academy up in record time, by the way. And we did that by collaborating. So we collaborated with the local council, Derby City Council. The University of Derby were a huge influence and part of the success. The Nuclear Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, the National College for Nuclear, and also the Ministry of Defence, actually, in the UK, were massive players in getting this set up and established. And it takes all of those skills and experiences in order to launch something like a Skills Academy. Beyond the early careers, as you've said, we now want to move into mid-career training, because it's quite interesting. You can break the skills, actually, in the nuclear sector into sort of three parts. Nuclear skills themselves, which are, the type of skills that require in-depth knowledge and a lot of experience, things like nuclear physics, as an example. Second one would be skills for nuclear. So if you wanted to be, a program manager in the nuclear industry, you need a lot of tacit knowledge and some learning to understand how the industry operates and how the business operates. And then there's some more generic skills, like finance, HR, et cetera, which are really important to us. but don't require the level of nuclear understanding and knowledge, say, for the other two. And what's really interesting is we've gone out to explore skills and recruitment, et cetera, from other industries. You know, maybe that be oil and gas or the car industry. Even finance actually have got the right analytical skills to move into nuclear. And the Skills Academy provides that conduit to enable people to come in, do, say, 6 months worth of training, go out into the business, and then come back and continue their professional development as part of the Skills Academy. So that's one of the sort of aspirations. The other aspiration is to grow to offer this Skills Academy in the UK at the moment in Derby is very much for Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce can't be successful on its own. We need a really robust supply chain. So we need to help our suppliers actually who maybe don't have the same resources available to them, the same influence as a company like Rolls-Royce has, helping our supply chain. And also, you know, as I said, nuclear training. So Rolls-Royce has got, you know, well over 60 years experience in a pressurized water reactor. We know an awful lot about it, you know, both pressurized water reactor as well as advanced nuclear and into fusion as well. So we need to get ourselves to a position where we can share that experience and we can offer some nuclear training as well to the wider industry. We've got aspirations and desires and a vision to move the Skills Academy forward.
So the Skills Academy is eventually going to become basically a constant touch point for people throughout their career, whether they're getting into the nuclear sector or they're skilling up within the nuclear sector or they're transferring their knowledge back to the next generations as they leave or as they retire from the nuclear sector. That's a really great way to keep a consistent source of knowledge that rotates through with the people, but continually builds and grows in both applicability and efficacy over time. I really like that.
Yes, I mean, it's hugely important. You know, I mean, the UK as well as the rest of the world have got a huge challenge with, defence security and energy security. And nuclear is a sustainable fuel, you know, so it's a real good option to carbon fuels. And hugely important we invest, you know, and we've got a good ecosystem in place, you know, that grows the skills. And it's not just a company or a business problem. It's a problem for society. So it's really important that we team and we collaborate well with academia and you know, all the key research partners to ensure that we do it in the right way and get the best from it. You know,
absolutely. Collaboration seems like it's key to realizing most of these things. As you identify, there are so many different kinds of skills and professionals needed to be able to convey the knowledge. No one person can hold everything in their head at one time, although some people might come close. But it seems like it really takes all of us to be able to actually get the both skills applied and then those applied skills transferred back to others. Now, the overarching theme of this upcoming global forum is ambition into action, which is really all about the idea that it's great to have ideas. Ideas are awesome. They're the seed of changing the future. But on their own, ideas don't actually achieve anything. They don't help anyone. You have to be able to put a plan in place. You have to be able to implement. You have to turn them into something that becomes actionable and that can create that change. Sanjay, are there some times besides what you're doing with the Asia School of Business where you've turned your own ambitions into actions? The keyword micro-credentials comes to mind.
Well, yes. You're right. Taking an idea, a conception, right? Something that happens in your mind and turning it into action is not easy. And so, yes, we did invent something called the MicroMasters. I had a spectacular team at MIT, a couple of professors, me and Yossi Sheffi, who's the head of the Center for Transportation Logistics at MIT. He and I cooked it up. working with this team, and then a few months later to launch it and to see the see students line up, take the courses, work through all the little bugs and the niggles that hold you back, with do it calmly, and then to see it succeed, to issue the first micro credential, and to cross a million enrollments is a very it's a very fulfilling journey. It is risky because it is difficult to take an idea and put into action, but more difficult to contemplate failure. One of the things about innovating is it takes a little bit of something between recklessness and bravery. And to confront the possibility of failure, to even step into it, to have the resiliency to sort of navigate, rebound, and then keep at it, is very, it's a wonderful thing, of course, looking back once you've succeeded, but many who do good things don't succeed, and we should celebrate them equally for trying. But taking the first step is, I know it sounds like a cliche, but going, you know, just putting one foot in front of another, and keep on going is what it takes. And I hope we see more of it because it's a desperate need right now in education.
I've heard that as an entrepreneur, it's very common that most, maybe, of your ideas will not necessarily be successful, and that it takes a consistent drive to pursue, even in the face of failure, even as you experience failure, to continue to either try and translate that failure into a success, or to adequately recognize when it is time to abandon a concept and move on to the next idea. Can you share a little bit about how you personally have overcome some of those challenges, or how you have faced the idea of failure like that and continued to succeed in spite of it?
Yeah, I think we need to reconceptualize failure quite fundamentally, and let me explain. So let's say it's very dark, there's absolutely no light, and you enter this room, let's think of it as a classroom with tables and chairs, and there's someone injured at the other end. There's no light whatsoever, and you have to find your way to that person. Well, you're going to forgive yourself, won't you, for bumping into a chair or a table, for toppling something, but you recognize there's urgency, and you move on. You dust yourself off, you rub your knee, and you get to that person, and you try and get them out of there, and hopefully retrace your path and get them out of there. The thing about entrepreneurship, think about innovation, is we think we can see, but we can't. It's a sort of a false sight. You think you know what's in front of you, but you actually can't really see. You're actually probing an unknown space. And failure is simply you bumping into that chair or table and learning. This illusion of sight, especially hindsight, is what I think society tends to suffer from often. And the person who's willing to walk into the dark and recognize actually that you can't see and get their shin injured a little bit, or tumble and look silly but get up, those are the people who take us forward. I'll give you an example. I think his name is John Marshall, got the Nobel Prize for claiming that ulcers, stomach ulcers, a large fraction of them, were caused not by stress, but by a particular bacterium, Helicobacter pylori. And it was difficult for him to say to others that it wasn't the case, because everyone else had vision, quote unquote. They could see that it wasn't. But he could see that they were sort of blind, actually. And so was he. He had this theory, and eventually, actually, I think he swallowed Helicobacter pylori, gave it to himself, and cured himself to prove that that was the case. So, you know, we just need to reframe what vision means and what failure means. We really are probing the unknown. We need to recognize and celebrate the people who have the guts to do so.
And that's such an important lesson for us as potential and present and future innovators, that a failure is an opportunity to identify either challenges or issues that you have with your current approach, or to simply understand the environment better that you're functioning within. That is a great way to put it, that we have this false sight of what's in front of us. And the only way to understand it is to probe the environment, which, you know, maybe it means getting our shins bumped by something. I really like that. It takes effort and it takes putting yourself out there and it takes putting your ideas out there into reality for them to encounter obstacles that can help both define the ideas and to define the space your ideas sit within. That's a really great way to frame it. I appreciate that, Sanjay.
Could I just add to, compliment what Sanjay's just said, if I could. In industry, we've moved our sort of recruitment policy, if you like, to more of recruit for behaviours and train for skills, because we've recognised that it's hugely important, actually, to have the right behaviours, to progress and develop our business in the way really Sanjay's just described there. We've got extensive access to expertise, knowledge and skills, got a very good lessons learned and knowledge management process. But unless you've got the right behaviours in the business, you don't change. You're not flexible. You're not agile to new situations. You don't accommodate surprises quite in the right way, in the way you should. So having those behaviours is hugely important. And for our young people, we look for those employability skills, of course, of being able to communicate and problem solve and teamwork. But as you move through your career, it's really important that, you can take a piece of information and take some rational risk, but still make a decision. You are agile and flexible to an arising, whether it be bumping into a chair in a dark room or a more technical problem. You need to collaborate, recognize you don't have all of the information yourself or within your team or within your company. So you need to be able to look outside and, seek the right advice and information. And then the other thing is sort of keeping things really simple. Don't over complicate things, particularly in an engineering environment across the industry, we're really good at that. We find that easy. We sort of drop into that mode straight away when we don't need to. Requirements, keep your requirements clear, clear and simple, and respond with the appropriate solution. And if that's a very simple one, but it's appropriate, then that's the way to go. So behaviors hugely important to us in industry.
Now, it makes sense. Skills are something that it's easy to transfer. It's a lot more difficult to teach someone to have an open mind. That's not to say it can't be done, but if you're looking for people and you need them now, then it makes sense to find people who have the mindset you need, the willingness to ask questions, the willingness to keep their eyes open and their ears peeled for, anything that could happen in their environment, both in the physical environment around them and in the idea environment that they work within, and then be able to explain to them specifically the subjects that you want them to understand if they don't already know. That makes sense. Now, we are just about at the end of our time together. I really appreciate both of you signing on in the morning and the evening so that we can have this discussion. We have a couple of minutes left, and so I would just like to get your last thoughts on a particular question. So starting with Sanjay, as we move towards the future, as we look towards cultivating a workforce that is capable of not only handling, identifying, and tackling the challenges that we're only just starting to conceive of today, do you have a vision for what this kind of future workforce will behave like, how they'll act, the kinds of attributes that will make them up? What is that successful workforce that can thrive in a complex, unknown future?
Well, I think that what Steve just said, which is you recruit for behavior and you train for skills. So what I'll add to that is we need to recruit people and train them to learn. Learning used to be a one-shot deal because, you learned a skill and you practiced it the rest of your life. Learning is now dynamic. we have to become learning, unlearning, and relearning machines in this new world. And so I would like to see a future in which we train people on behaviors, and one of the behaviors has to be a behavior of constant self-renewal and a new contract where you go, this skill is going to last me this long, and it's going to change, and I'm going to relearn it, I'm going to upgrade myself, and I'm going to stay ahead of the game. Because we are entering, in my view, especially with ChatGPT and other things going on, a very different world now.
Yeah, it's such a dynamic future. The necessity to be able to be flexible. The world has historically gone through these big decadal changes, and society has shifted over the course of generations, but it seems like that's accelerating. Whether it's the internet, whether it's synthetic intelligences, whether it's something else, it seems like the pace of change is rapidly increasing. And a world 5 years from now may be wildly different than a world 2 years later. So building in continuous learning and self-evolution effectively as a fundamental part of the workforce is such a great way to look at it. Our body changes. Every cell in our body cycles through every 7 years or so. There's no reason that we shouldn't be able to reconceptualize ourselves on the same time scales. Faster may be a challenge, but I bet we can do it. We've got pretty elastic minds if we apply them. And Steve, for your parting question, effectively the same thing, but a little more focused. Given that you are dedicating so much time to cultivating the workforce of the nuclear industry in the future, what does that nuclear industry look like? What do you see as how the nuclear industry helps to bring itself to bear, bring technology to bear on the societal problems we see today, and some we may not even know?
There's a huge opportunity, across, I mentioned defense security and energy security. The opportunities there for nuclear are just huge. There's the opportunity to develop technology. So technology in the nuclear industry has been growing at a slow pace. That'll increase massively. That'll require more innovation, more creativity, more automation. Digital and AI will play a big part in that. And that'll force us to think very, very differently, through life, through career, upskilling, reskilling will play a big part in that. But I think also there's the pipeline as well, back into beyond universities, back into secondary schools, into early education, actually, and educating our young people of different energy alternatives and what the future could hold for them and the career options, because it's really exciting for sure,
I think that's a great vision. So that is the time we have. Sanjay, Steve, I want to thank you so much for calling in today. It has been excellent to talk with you. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I have learned quite a few things, and I think a lot of our listeners will as well. And I look forward to being able to experience and participate in these futures you envision. I think it's going to be a wonderful place. And I appreciate the work you're doing to make sure that we have the people ready to excel in them. And with that, we will close out this podcast and see you on our next one. Thank you for listening to this special limited series of the EPRI Current podcast. For more information about the Global Forum for Nuclear Innovation, visit globalnuclearinnovation.com.